The annals would have told us that there were animal smells, horned cattle, lumpen ewes. There would have been the sweat of labour, soft cries of accepted pain, the sensible music of tenderness and love, and the scent of night jasmine, perhaps the triumphant hoot of the tawny owl under the white, unflickering stars. In a painting of the stable, the crib, Giotto has the infant child, newly born, being held in human hands. He is naked, being bathed, and the artist would have us know that this is the God, the creator of the cosmos, giving himself over into the care of human beings. This is the child, flung by the waves of eternity up onto a stone-shocked shore. The French composer Olivier Messiaen will see this moment as the beginning of an incredible exchange. The one who is divine, exchanging divinity for the dangers and sufferings of human living, and offering in exchange that humanity, that lumpen mortal species, the opportunity to win divinity. One who is often overlooked in the great images and discussions of the Nativity is Joseph, Yosef, the husband of Mary, Miriam. I see him firstly stunned by wonder and awe at the human child, Jesus, Yeshua. Those baby fingers, marvels of perfection, cuticle and lunula, wafer delicate as the white moth's wing. Cosmic, too, with universe upon universe depending, wrinkled like walnut skin, thoroughly beautiful, though without beauty. This swaddle-swathed detainee of Earth. Joseph would have been very conscious of the dangers in the world at that time, as, sadly, the world now and in our time. With the Roman occupation, the sense of war, for he was wondering how to protect him, this child, from Herod and Caesar and tyrant, from the common avarice, the luxury, the urge to empire. His new boy child, just born, to be held tenderly in a world suffering the tyranny of untruths, wars abroad, and the body politic at ruck in bad faith. And Joseph, Yeshua, who is he then? A seasoned, broad-chested, working man, wholly dependable, taking the place of the everlasting Yahweh God from everlasting to everlasting. I see him, this young, new father, Joseph, coming outside that night to sit back against the side wall, his head in his hands, shaking. It is the ordinary, the most beautiful and impossible wonder of our world, this, the birth of a child. Now he promises to teach him the names of God, Yahweh and El Shaddai, Elohim of wine and bread, heart's ease, heartache, majesty and squalor. For this is familiar townland where neighbor knows neighbor, and everyone can tell how the first child takes all of your life, fastens it tight in its soft flesh fists. In the annals of my own life, I recall one Christmas night, starlight on the island road, and behind a hedge, the churring song of a nightjar, that secretive, night-hiding-in-night great bird. And I knew that the music within the human spirit is unheard until it is played. And even the angels who bear you up cannot avert the dangers and the suffering ahead. Flesh and matter, things of blood and skin and tissue. And as the night of the incarnation turned to a slow dawn light, coming soft as dewfall over the earth, where Joseph sat and waited, he could hear, outside the birthplace, a grasshopper begin its morning cheer, cheer, cheer out there, invisible amongst the grasses. And soon he would hear the creaking of the olive press, the grinding of the millstone, the ordinary sounds of a familiar townland. Although we know that the world had changed utterly, an impossible beauty had transformed the whole of creation that night, and nothing would ever be quite the same again. Joseph, Yosef, sits in the warming light of a new day, in the scent of lemon blossom, and thinks quietly of the demanding happiness of his loves, the child asleep in his own depths and snoring softly, and a woman, young in tenderness and old in wisdom. And he knows the overwhelming wonder of being alive and the stilled certainties of loneliness and of being loved. He gets up, goes back inside the birthing place, and great words of affection and hope are spoken over the child, falling drop upon drop, slow, slow, like a note recurrent on the white key of a grand piano. Let us inquire, then, of the horned beasts of the world, and they, with their great wide-open eyes, will inquire of you, what, then, shall this child be?
In the music video for Last Christmas by Wham, glowing, attractive and happy people with skis cavort in the snow before retreating to an alpine lodge. Although there are some lingering sad looks because George's partner is now with Andrew, the overall impression is of wonderful times. The snow is thick and white, and everyone wears beautiful coats. In the milk tray advert of the 70s, a man, sleek in black, descends the slopes by ski, leaping periodically into an azure sky, all because his lady needs the chocolates. When in 1984, a handwritten note was pinned on a notice board in a County Antrim school asking, "Are you interested in a ski trip?" These two key snow-related texts were no doubt in the minds of many of the students who thought, "Do you know what? Yes, I am interested in a ski trip." And so, a group gathered to hear that the trip would happen the week before Christmas. It would cost £140, and it would be to Pampurovo in Bulgaria. Practically no one had ever skied before, and most of us, in our parochial teenage way, weren't sure where Bulgaria was, but we couldn't sign up quick enough. In order to prepare for the downhill experience, it was arranged that we would travel to a place some distance outside Belfast for dry skiing lessons. The Dry Ski Centre approximated an arrangement of what seemed to be outsized bristled doormats on a 45-degree slope. But some people loved the dry skiing. They immediately had a knack for it. I found it difficult to get up the slope, never mind come down it. "Don't worry, love," the instructor said. "When you actually get on real snow, I can tell you are going to be a natural." This was something I doubted. In the weeks leading up to the trip, there was also the hiring of the salopettes. In the shop, I stared forlornly at the reflection in the mirror, a two-piece ensemble of salopettes and ski jacket in baggy brown nylon. I imagined a Vida loaf hesitantly moving down a mountainside. "Have you not got anything in black or tighter?" I asked. "Are you imagining yourself as the milk tray man?" the woman asked. "Oh, no way, not at all." Although I was imagining myself as the milk tray man. "Well," the woman said, "brown's all we got. But I did get some new clothes for the trip. A thin, fake leather jacket and thin, fake leather skirt. People said I would be freezing. I didn't care." And so, the week before Christmas, a plane took off from Aldergrove to Plovdiv in Bulgaria. 30 suitcases stuffed with the same brown padded nylon from the same shop. But when it touched down, there was no whiteness. Just tarmac. Black tarmac. "Where's the snow?" we demanded. The teachers weren't overly perturbed. "Where we're heading to is 60 miles away," they said. "It's up in the mountains. There'll be snow up there." The bus made its way towards Pampurovo. At one point, one of the teachers said, "Kids, you do realise that we're behind the Iron Curtain?" We peered out, expecting to see some corrugated iron structure. But all we saw was no snow. At the hotel, there had been a mix-up with the booking. Everyone would now have to share a single bed with another pupil. There was, it must be said, a little snow, a light skiff, enough for a paltry snowball maybe, but not enough for skiing. The disappointment hung heavy. There was a disco that played Europop and also, perhaps surprisingly, Killing Joke. It became a regular nighttime haunt for everyone. But we were up a mountain in a tiny village with only a couple of hotels. Although there was no snow, it was freezing. The fake leather jacket and skirt were a mistake. Days were spent lying on the single beds, eating sweets and talking about what we would do at Christmas when we got back home, or trying on each other's clothes. We were bored a lot of the time. In the evenings in the hotel, there was a band that would play Beatles covers while we had our dinner. Not too many people were sorry when the week was over, and the brown salopettes were returned unused to the shop. 2 years later, in 1986, the record label 4AD released a recording of traditional folk songs performed by the women's chorus of Bulgarian state radio. It sold 100,000 copies, and I loved listening to it. And so, when I recall this holiday, my memories of the coach journeys through the countryside and the mountains out the window of the hotel room were transmogrified a little, since they were soundtracked by the amazing and strange close harmonies of those Bulgarian women. But in the mix, Wham was still there.
My Aunt Catherine says that funerals are generally more fun than weddings. Unlike weddings, where everything, clothes, hair, transport, lodging, is planned long in advance, funerals, she says, are impromptu. They catch people off guard in the middle of their lives, and therefore they give you a more authentic sense of them. The Nativity in the Gospels is supposed to be very planned. It's meant to fulfill, to the letter, a series of Old Testament prophecies concerning the coming of the Messiah. But to me, what's most striking about the Christmas story in the New Testament is how improvised and chaotic the whole thing is. In Nazareth, Mary is unexpectedly pregnant. There's hardly time to discuss it, though, because they have to rush to Bethlehem for an urgent bureaucratic appointment. While they're on the trip there to fill in the Roman census forms, Mary, wouldn't you know it, goes into labor. They don't know anyone in Bethlehem. The hotel's already full. There are no midwives left. So they have to improvise a place to stay and figure out a cot for the newborn. The three wise men, too, have been planning this for ages. They have their presents bought and wrapped. They think they know the way. But they, too, get lost and have to ask directions. As a result, they end up accidentally spilling the beans to King Herod, almost ruining the whole thing. Once everyone is there, we can imagine the giddy feeling of them all, finding themselves together in a strange place, like giggly pupils on a school tour. We treat the first Christmas as an eternal event. As the Wexford Carol says, Doras an chro na dún gudio, may the stable door never shut. But it does shut. They're all just passing through. They all leave again in a hurry, Mary, Joseph and baby for Egypt, the wise men back east. The only ones left behind in Bethlehem are the shepherds, who, after the flurry of miracles, high drama and glamorous visitors, get back to their work and routine, like locals in a country village which has just hosted a celebrity wedding. For the first part of my life, I was like the shepherds, watching unfamiliar visitors come back to our road for Christmas and then leaving again in the new year. In the early 1980s, returning emigrants, the older siblings of neighbors, people 10, 15, 20 years older than me, would show up, a missing generation suddenly crowding into our small, damp world. They looked and felt different from us, streetwise and struggling, slightly foreign, more interested in joining their friends in the pub than in families, neighbors, or mass. For the duration of Christmas week, I would see them striding anxiously past in their pale denim jackets, stud earrings, and white ankle boots, presumably hurrying to meet the rest of their returning friends and swap news of the complicated lives they had briefly left behind in Queens and Cricklewood and Munich. Once Christmas had passed, they vanished back again into the distant darkness they'd come from. Living abroad in my 20s and 30s, I became one of these uncertain pilgrims myself. For many years, all I saw of Ireland was Christmas. My experience of the fabled Celtic tiger was limited to a dazzled midwinter glimpse once a year. In some ways, I barely saw the boom. There were queues outside Brown Thomas, the lights on Grafton Street were blinding and opulent, the pubs rang with slightly Americanized consonants. But the great changes to the nation were partly hidden from me by the unchanging rituals of Christmas itself. And my own ritual return was also a predictable, pre-planned round of nights out with the same old friends, tours of the same relations' houses, the same goosebumps at the sound of the same old songs. As in the biblical nativity, however, Christmas plans go awry. Money runs out, people don't show up, turkeys fail. And for me too, the ritual reunions with familiar faces would be interrupted by unexpected encounters, as when I went into town, I'd find myself confronted on Nassau Street or Dawson Street by a face which had long vanished or been scrubbed from my memory. A long-lost love, a childhood rival, a forgotten friendship that never quite made it beyond primary school. Sometimes the person I ran into would not realize I'd been gone for 20 years and would just nod in polite greeting. Sometimes decorum required us to stop, put our bags down, and have a chat for a few minutes. Occasionally, we squeezed into Kyo's or Neary's for an awkward pint. In these conversations, instead of really listening, we were scrutinizing each other's features and personalities to observe how time had transformed them. Not just our softened, jowlier faces, or that sort of double look with which experience slowly fills people's eyes, but also our personalities, the way people become a little less angular and singular, smoothed out, a little more like everybody else, as though we are all gradually pickled in the juices of convention. Once terrifying bullies offer affable handshakes and sociable smiles. The eccentric geniuses of yesteryear used to only speak Irish or talk about socialist revolutions, now say things like, "Are you home for long? Doing a bit of teaching now for me sins? Give my regards to your folks now, won't you?" These are not the kind of encounters where you swap numbers or friend each other on Facebook. You know, the only way you might see each other again would be through another highly unlikely coincidence. So when you pick up your Hodges Figgis bags again and say goodbye, it might as well be the final farewell, the last salute we give each other before time swallows us up for good, before we go the way of all Christmas ghosts. Like the nativity story in the Gospels, the miraculous, secret knowledge Christmas makes us privy to is not just, as I used to think, the sense of what is recurring and eternal. It is also the experience of all that is passing and quick, all that can't be held onto or relied upon, that which can only be glimpsed and understood in fleeting visions, sudden flashes of truth that can only occur when plans are interrupted and when there is no guarantee of repeats or returns.
Is. You look gorgeous. I dedicate this to my kids, Cathal and Micheál. Santa loves you very much, and so do your ma and da. When I was a kid, I thought Saturday trips to the Finglas Credit Union were just as much a part of the run-up to Christmas as Advent Masses, Christmas carols, and a trip to see Santa in Switzers. Every Friday evening, Da would leave a few bob in the credit union book and place it under the statue of St. Anthony. Seemingly, your man Anthony was a great fella for helping you find a few bob for the crimbo. Da couldn't go to the credit union on Saturdays because he was a buttercrust delivery man and he worked from 5 a.m. until 5 p.m. So he asked the 4 youngest of his 10 kids to help their ma with the messages and the credit union man. It was a big job, but we were well able. In 1979, talk of the Christmas credit union loans seemed to be all the go on our estate. I'd been earwigging. Adults were grousing about the queues for petrol, the bank taking houses, and whole families moving to Australia. I didn't understand how a bank could take a family's home, or why anyone would want to go all the way to Australia when everyone knew the best rope swings, the best Halloween bonfires, and the best snowball fights were to be had in Finglas. But for that November, and most of December, we made the track from our estate to the village and the Finglas Credit Union. I love that walk. Myself and my brothers would chase after each other. The ma would shout, "Mind yourselves, mind the cars flying up and down that dual carriageway." Us kids would shimmy along the top of the wall by Thompson's Field. It was only 3 feet tall, but it was massive in our heads. Sometimes we sauntered back to the ma. She'd be pushing the pram and she'd let us have a scut on the footrest or a little jaunt on the handlebars. That last Saturday before Christmas in the Finglas Credit Union was the crack. The line was long and there were kids all over the place. Someone had put up a Christmas tree in the corner near the queue. It was decorated with yards of silver tinsel and multicoloured lights. There was even a big plastic Santa by the front door. He wore his famous red suit and big black boots. His smile was wide, and his cheeks were as red as his suit. We were supposed to stand in the queue and wait with me ma, but like the other kids, we got bored of that waiting malarkey. So we moseyed off to have a good gawk at the Christmas tree, or maybe even give Plastic Santa a poke. Well, you never know. Santa has his spies everywhere. It wasn't long before I was trying to reef a bit of tinsel from the Christmas tree. I wanted me ponytail to have some Christmas decorations. And then I'd look exactly like one of those girls from the Brady Bunch. I was using me fingernail as a saw to cut through the piping of the silver tinsel, when suddenly there was a bit of a crash and the kerfuffle of kids running back to the queue and their folks. Someone had knocked over big plastic Santa. I looked over at the ma. Wasn't me. Wasn't me brothers. We were here by the Christmas tree the whole time. Still and all, I replaced the bit of tinsel, gave me brothers the nod, and we returned to the queue for the credit union man. I was swinging out of the pram's handlebars as I watched the security man making a big to-do, and all he had to do was pick up poor plastic Santa. I'd love a go at picking up poor plastic Santa. Maybe I could hug him, and maybe he would come to life and tell me not to worry. Me roller skates were on the way. The elves were up in the North Pole doing 90, but I was definitely in line for a new pair of roller skates. Back in the queue, an elf one was whinging. And have you seen the prices? They're shocking. I don't know how we'll cope if they refuse us this credit union loan. Something about the looks on the other adults' faces, the guffaws, raised eyebrows, and the sighs made me ask loud, why do we need a credit union loan for Christmas and anyway? I mean, Santa brings all the toys. The adults in the queue went quiet. Then the ma said, well, Levine, turkeys ain't cheap. The woman beside her piped in with, and the price of ham has gone sky high this year. An older lady, two people up in the queue, gave me a stern look and said, ah, now, Missy Moo, do you think they're handing out those fancy tins of biscuits for free? An elfla beside me ma chimed in with, to say nothing of the price of gargle. I mean, you have to buy in the stout and get a bottle of whiskey in case the visitors fancy a drop to celebrate the season and all. Ma tidied up me ponytail. Yes, love, Santa brings the presents, but it's me and your da who buy all them Christmas groceries and the selection boxes for you's kids. Grand so. I looked over at big plastic Santa. He was standing back up by the credit union door. He had had a fall, but there wasn't a mark on him. He looked as good as new. Thanks very much.
We didn't have Christmas decorations in our house when I was a child. My father thought Christmas trees were a waste of money. My mother just didn't like Christmas. so a few sprigs of holly were the only sign of festivity. Until the year I was 8, and my godmother gave me a crib. It was the full regalia. Apart from Mary, Joseph, and the baby, he was separate from his little manger and could be put in at the last moment on Christmas Eve. Not that I was ever able to wait that long. It had two shepherds, one with a lamb across his shoulders, the three kings, and a page boy. The livestock comprised the ox and ass, of course, two sturdy sheep, one lying down, and a camel for the king's entourage. And there was a thatched roofed stable with side gates that could be detached. I wasn't of an age to find the existence of thatched roofs and swing gates in Judea 2,000 years ago a bit bizarre. It was a cracker. And each year I rearranged it daily in the run-up to Christmas, with the kings and their camels starting at the edge of the table to signify the distance they were traveling, while the shepherds huddled a short distance from the stable beneath a small pile of hedge cuttings from the garden to signify their need for shelter from the storm. It was good as a play in my mind as the action progressed daily, the kings trudging ever closer. In my teens, my determined Christmas spirit had so far infected the household that we had a small Christmas tree, albeit an artificial one, which stood crookedly and a trifle forlornly in the bay of the dining room window, managing at least to cast a Christmassy shadow when the table candles were lit. But my crib retained its star status, even if the figures now remain static throughout the Christmas period. When I left my parents' house for my first flat, most of my belongings were left behind, temporarily, I thought. It turned out to be permanent. Not only did my entire childhood and teenage library disappear into the ether, probably the St. Vincent de Paul Society, but my crib was gone as well when I went to collect it. It was in the way, my mother said. It was in the attic, I said. But even with the advent of adulthood and a relegation of the Christmas story to the realms of delightful fairy tale in my consciousness, I never lost my fondness for the Christmas crib. So I was outraged a few years ago when the nameless authorities of the health service, in a misplaced and ham-handed attempt at inclusiveness, whatever that meant, banned cribs from all public hospitals for fear of giving offense. And after such a joyless banning of the tidings of great joy, at which children had gasped for generations with stars in their eyes, On Post then issued a Christmas stamp, which didn't show what my mother used to call the Christmas subject. No more the young mother gazing at her newborn child, shown in miniature, but still recognizable, and giving a joyous surge of the spirit of Christmas, manifest of generosity and fellowship, as each tiny image was thumped on an envelope. I have no objection to a Christmas robin or a snowman in the tiny space, but it was the abandoning of a heart-lifting annual tradition to political correctness that was so offensively joyless. I was in hospital overnight on December 19th last year. I was already exhausted in the pre-Christmas rush, ticking off lists, trying to see friends, even briefly, whom I hadn't seen for the previous year, assuring the younger generation that I could manage the Christmas tree on my own. I'm a perennial worry to my nieces, having acquired a surgery necessitating injury to my shoulder some years ago in the process of decorating a tree. But as I checked in at reception in this determinedly Roman Catholic hospital, outside the remit of either HSE or Department of Health, there it was, a large crib dominating the lobby. It was fairly hideous, but my heart lifted with every flash of its circlet of fairy lights. The previous week, I'd been in a voluntary public hospital for tests. There had been lots of decorations, most provided by staff, who brought in their own spares from home. Not exactly pristine, although the joy was there, but no crib, banned in the name of inclusivity. Santa Claus is there, mind you, and it occurred to the authorities that he too has his origin in religion, the modern incarnation of St. Nicholas, who trudged through the frozen wastes to bring gifts to deprived children. By the way, I have proof he exists. In the bleak winter of the Great Freeze of 2010, I told a friend as we had our annual celebratory lunch the story of the demise of my childhood crib. On Christmas Eve, in the midst of mountainous snowdrifts and waterless taps, a taxi pulled up outside my house. My friend emerged. An enormous box was unloaded. Opened, it held the figures of a porcelain crib. And each year since, in my very secular household, with Santa Claus beaming from the top of the stairs, the crib has pride of place in the hall, the baby Jesus seeming to me to wave his fat little fist in joyous welcome in the bleak midwinter with promise of joy to come.
On this morning's programme, we heard That Night by John F. Dean, Bulgarian Winter Wonderland by Wendy Erskine, Passing Through by Barry McRae, Christmas in the Finglas Credit Union by Rachel Hegarty, and A Tale of Two Cribs by Emer O'Kelly. The music, all performed by the RTE Concert Orchestra and conducted by Gavin Maloney, was Sheep May Safely Graze by Johann Sebastian Bach, Hungarian Dance No. 5 by Johannes Brahms, The Wexford Carol, arranged by Fergus O'Carroll and sung by Zoe Conway and John McIntyre, Santa Claus is Coming to Town by John Frederick Coutts and Haven Gillespie, arranged by Gavin Murphy, sung by Joe Petit, and O Holy Night by Adolphe Adam, arranged by William Ryden and Brian Byrne and sung by Sinead Campbell-Wallace.